podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today's guest is my good friend Mark Denton. And if you've read the blog, you'll know this, but I'm going to repeat it anyway. He's been a fantastic art director, creative director, director. He's owned and run two brilliant production companies, a design company. He's won awards in every area he's worked in. He's been president of the Creative Circle. So a very creative person in his professional life, but you know, more than anyone else, he lives creativity. You know, his house is art directed to within an inch of its life. His clothes are made to his specifications, again, an expression of his creativity. His moustache is an expression of his creativity. So I think there are lots of lessons that we can learn because he's been in some really fantastic positions within the industry, but he's just an incredible creative person and a lovely bloke. So without further ado, here is my chat with Mark Denton. Hi, Mark. Great to speak to you on Saturday. Thanks for making the time. And I thought I'd ask, because I've asked this of the other people and it's a good place to start, why and how did you get into advertising in the first place?
Oh, that's you know, I've got to think back a bit because it's 40 years ago. I've just had my 40th anniversary in advertising. So it's a bloody long time ago. I only went to art college by mistake. I was going to be a hairdresser. It was hairdressing or panel beating and spraying was my two things that I was going to do because I was quite arty. And my uncle went to art college. He was a silversmith. And I thought, well, I'll give that a go. I tried to get into Croydon Art College. They wouldn't have me because I didn't have enough O-levels. So I was polishing my screw on my dad's drive one afternoon, and this bloke on a moped started talking to me about scooters. And it just so happened he was going to the local art college, Ravensbourne. But it wasn't a proper art school. It was a school of vocational studies where you didn't have to have a lot of O-levels. So I got in there. And when I was there, I became a paste-up artist after that on Knitter's Digest. And it just so happened that my boss knew someone in an advertising agency, and I went to Leo Burnett as a visualiser. So it was all by mistake, really.
So as a visualiser, that means for the people who are not, I think I was probably the last generation to have visualisers in an office. These are the people who will illustrate your stuff. If you go, I'd like to, can you draw me a picture of like a chicken walking on top of a man's head or something like that? Is that the kind of thing?
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, to be honest, yeah, I was a visualiser, but I was actually officially the assistant to Mike Brandt, who was the head typographer there. And he did a bit of art direction on the side, but he couldn't draw, so I was hired to draw his layouts up.
Okay, and from there, how did you become an art director, I guess, a creative, like in the creative department?
Well, there was... They didn't have a chair for me. So I was Mike Brandt's assistant, but they didn't have a chair in his office. So there was only one desk in a half-empty office because it was there was this senior art director called Norman Icke, who'd been doing it a bloody long time. He started at the Open Air when it was the London Press Exchange. So I was in a desk in his office, and he used to disappear at 11 o'clock every day to go down the pub. So... when the photographer's reps and the production company reps used to ring up and say, oh, can I show you a book or a reel or something like that? I used to answer the phone and say, yeah, come around and show me, make an appointment between 11 and 3. And I used to see him and pretend I was the art director. So I pretended I was an art director and then I became one.
Great. So, I mean, you've told me this before. I mean, I don't know, because I think if I went through your career, that would probably be 3 hours of in terms of the journey of your career. So I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit and go, I've heard how you got together with Chris Palmer, but I think it's a great story. So could you just tell us how that happened?
Well, because I was visualising mainly. I did a poster, I think, and that they asked me to draw up some storyboards and come up with some ideas for Cadbury's Cream Eggs, mainly for posters. But... did these storyboards for me bosses, but I squeezed one of mine in there and showed it to the account group before my boss, and he got ball. So despite the fact that Norman Ike and Bob Stenners were furious that I got my head through research and they didn't get theirs made, I ended up at Shepperton or Pinewood, some big studio, on this bloody great big 17th century street scene that had been built there with Charlie Drake, who was a very famous comedian at the time, and shooting with Barry Myers. And this bloke wandered in from the next stage, I should say, Chris Palmer. He was shooting something for BBH with Graham Rose, Shapes and Ivor Yogurt. It's all coming back to me now. Anyway, he had a little tabletop thing, and I had this bloody great big 17th century street scene, or 16th century, I don't know, I'm not very good at
centuries. It's all the same.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. Anyway, he started chatting to me and said, look, I've been working with John Hegarty for the last 6 months. He'd come straight out of college, went back to being a dispatch rider, was delivering a package to BBH, and before you know it, he's working with John Hegarty. It's his first job, while Barbara Noakes was on maternity leave. Anyway, Barbara was coming back. He needed a new art director. He was really impressed with this this one job that I did, this one commercial that I shot. And before you know it, I'm working over at BBH.
That is an unconventional kind of teaming up thing. I mean, I think even the idea of like wandering onto someone else's shoot while you're in a sort of shoot complex. Don't know how many people do that. That's obviously, Chris was like, yeah, why not? Let's go and have a look. And then also, rather than go, is there someone spare in the office for me to team up with? I think the way you put it before was that, you know, he insisted on you being his art director against a bit of resistance.
I wasn't a natural choice, far from it. You know, I had bugger all sexy print work in my book. I had loads of rough, so I had loads of storyboards because I was a visualizer. So I wrote loads of scripts, but I put them all in my portfolio in storyboard form. And of course, you know, they're harder to read than the finished thing. So I wasn't the obvious choice at BBH, which was the sexiest print agency in town at the time. They were doing the best art directed stuff. And because it was a relatively junior position, I think I was expected to have a little bit more of a grounding in art direction. But Chris really pushed for me to be there. You know, it was against the management's wishes to start off with. But I got in there and I thought, bloody hell, I better pedal hard now, otherwise I'll get found out. And it all worked out all right in the end.
That is quite an interesting combination, because you're saying you're relatively junior. Chris, I think, had won like 6 pencils or something ridiculous for Levi's Russia and had been working with John Hegarty. So,
yeah, 6
pencils. Yeah, but the combination and Chris going, yeah, this relatively junior person who doesn't really fit in with the house style of this agency, I want him to be my art director and I'm going to go up against it and he's the one. So, I mean, I'm reckoning that Chris must have felt something almost simpatico or whatever with you that was maybe difficult to put your finger on. I mean,
well, he likes a chat and I like a chat, and that's why he wandered in and started chatting to me. And it was like a bloody great big live action cartoon set, because there was these sedan chairs that were powered by cream eggs in sort of donkey and carrot fashion, with a bit of a hot rod standoff and the cream egg powered sedan chair wins. First thing I ever got into DNA D'Annunzio. Chris was knocked out with it. It was a little bit unusual. And, you know, when we got chatting, he could see that I had the same kind of sensibilities, the same sort of puerile sensibilities. Style was good. There's only so much you can do with art direction. You know, I like impressing other art directors, but making my mum laugh was the most important thing. I think same with Chris, you know, we just like comedy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's kind of fascinating how people get thrown together just by circumstance, choose someone on the basis of their book, choose someone on the basis of a chat. I remember like how I chose the person I was working with at Watford. We both did some really, really weird stuff that I knew no one else would like. And I went, right, if you like that and I like that, then let's go and work together. It wasn't like, I know you're the best art director I've ever seen. It's just, we're going to think in a similar way in terms of what we think is good. And that was that. So I think there must be lots of ways that people get together in those partnerships.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, you're asking me things now that I really haven't thought about. I don't think about anything that deeply. I've only had about 3 copywriters in my whole career. You know, I'm 40 years in, and I've been a director for a lot of it. Yeah, my first one, Jennifer Kelly, she came from university and was posh. We didn't have a lot in common, but we had a right laugh, actually, thinking about it. That seemed to go all right. I think if anyone's any good, I think, especially, you don't have to be the same. It's great to have 2 different people as well. Jennifer was nothing like me, and I think we did some pretty good stuff together. 11 and a half years, something like that. He was bloody good, and we had a great fun for the whole time. You know, he was as driven as I was. He was more interested in work than he was going out and getting pissed up. Even though I don't mind doing that every now and then. Sure. But, it was the perfect partner, to be honest, from a creative point of view.
And from there you went to Lowe. And how and why did that happen?
Yeah, well, I was only at BBH for 2.5 years. And we wanted to do more telly. We were ambitious. You know, I loved doing print. We got loads of posters away. But, the department at BBH was growing. And obviously they couldn't give us all the telly to work on. And we got a few things to do. And John Egerty was great insofar as he gave us lots of rope and allowed us to fuck a few things up. In a very stylish way, of course.
Of course.
And, I learned a lot. But I wanted to do more comedy, more telly generally. And Lowe's was doing things like Heineken, and they were doing, Mike Stevenson, Derek Apps were doing lots of comedy stuff for the likes of Whitbread, was it, over there? Long time ago.
Yeah, I think so.
But they were doing lots of quirky comedy stuff, and we liked that. So Lowe's seemed like a good idea.
And so you worked your asses off at Lowe's. I think you did that thing where you took on a lot of the briefs that, you know, if there was a brief just hanging around, you guys just thrashed it out and, you know, while everyone's at the pub.
Heineken was open to everyone. And when the brief came around for Heineken, the poster campaign, and the telly, you know, I think the telly as well, we drew up 70. We actually drew them up. Because Chris was a bloody good, he was an illustrator, actually. He went to the illustration course. So between me, visualizer, Chris, illustrator, we were quite good at drawing and colouring in. So we actually drew up 70 posters and presented them. And so that year, I think we made 4 out of the 5 of the Heineken poster campaign, which was our last big award-winning job at Lowe's before this bloke I'd never heard of, Paul Simons, not the singer. This bloke who's an account man I'd never heard of phoned me up and said, "Do you want to start an agency?" And we just won these big prizes for the Heineken poster campaign.
And what was it about starting your own agency that, I mean, there's some obvious things that would appeal about that, but you were in a good place at Lowe. Why did you go, well, let's go and stop it all and go and do this thing instead?
I was doing well. I had a Vauxhall Astra GTE.
Wow.
And I was getting paid 40 grand a year, which was a lot of money for a young buck in 1988.
Yeah.
So with the offer of going setting up our own agency, putting 20 grand in, getting paid 20 grand a year and trading the Vauxhall Astra GTE in for a Mini, you know, the old ones, seemed very appealing. Yeah, it just seemed not a good idea based on, I've told you this story before, the first day I started working with Chris at BBH, I went to see my clairvoyant, Madame Claire of Catford, and she predicted that we would have our name over the door. So I thought, when the phone call came from Paul Simons, I cut the receiver and said, "Here, Chris, it's that bloody phone call with me." So it was a done deal. You can have your name over the door. Well, fair enough.
So everyone should go and see Madame Claire of Catford.
She's probably brown bread now. She
probably is.
This was a long time ago.
I wonder if she's got a daughter who could tell us all what's going to happen.
See, yeah, I used to go to the clairvoyants all the time. And I wouldn't go anymore because I'm getting on a bit. I don't want to know what next. I'd like to think I've got a few years left.
Cool. So we spoke a little bit before about how you listen to Dave Dye's thing. I'm really interested in the other side of those stories a little bit, because he said he used to go back and forth to you and Chris over quite a long period of time, hoping this call was the job call rather than the, oh, I see you've improved your book a bit call. Was that, did you have Dave on your radar and going, at some point we're going to get Dave? Or was it just, you know, whatever?
That's an easy one. Sorry for interrupting. That's an easy one. Because we would have taken Dave on the first day we saw him. Who would have came in with Mike McKenna? We would have taken both on. They had a bloody good book. Dead keen. And the fact is, we had bugger all money when we started up. You know, we just wanted to keep the pot stirred.
Yeah.
So we didn't bugger off and go and work for someone else. Oh. You know, so we wanted to know that we were interested. So every few months we'd say, yeah, come back in. But we didn't have any money to take him on. As soon as there was an opportunity, Mark Goodwin left. So, no, someone else left.
Tigers.
No, it's Gary Martin.
Oh, right, Gary Martin
left, and we got Dave in as soon as there was an available space. Had the pair of them left, we would have got Mike McKenna in with him. So it wasn't because we rated Dave and not Mike. They did some lovely stuff together. And we had bugger all money. That's why we had to get these... we tried to take it on a style early on, but two things. We didn't like paying them more money than we were paying ourselves, and they didn't listen to us. We got the hang of taking on unknowns.
So, I mean, that's kind of like Dave Trott's thing as well. But I was just going to mention, can we say the name of the star? Because I know who you mean, but I don't know if the other ones do, and I don't know if it would be a bit rude. So maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, no, better not.
All right, let's not. But... You had an expensive star and lots of young, hungry people, and the young, hungry people did more than, you know, the expensive star.
Yeah, well, they used to, when we used to say, no, you're not quite there yet, keep working, they would keep working.
Ah, there we go. So,
yeah.
So,
I think I've done enough, that's it.
And Dave talked a little bit about your method of... critiquing the work, where you just come round at 5:30, look at what was on the wall, and say you liked it or you didn't like it. Carry on, don't carry on.
Do you know what? Everything's you know, if you're a good creative, I think your gut feel is the most important thing. Then everything else is post-rationalisation or some sensible person trying to tell you why it's good. But if you're a good creative, you just know, and it's instinctive, and you don't, you know. I like to think I gave some constructive steers as well. But what I liked about Dave's, he remembered lots of things that I didn't, but what I liked about Dave's comments was that he said, oh yeah, I did this ad that was just like a Nike ad, all the award-winning Nike ads that we'd done. And then Mark said, yeah, great, you've done an ad that's just like all the others. Now make it different. But I did feel like, oh, we've done that. Before, you know, that looks like a Nike ad. Let's try and push it somewhere else. And I've forgotten I said that, but that, you know, for me, that's not a natural thing to do. That's why, you know, if you look at all the Nike ads, the type changes differently on every one.
Mm-hmm.
The colours change a little bit. They all hang together, but I always try to give them a little twist that just made them a little bit different from the one that came before.
Yeah, I think if anyone's listening to this, they want to look in the 1993 or 4 DNADs. And particularly 93, because I think like you won for mixed media there, and they look like completely different, and they're for slightly different campaigns. But there was that sort of 1960s sort of gig poster stuff, make love, not something or other with
Agassi.
Yeah. And then you had the stuff
Fate
for the
love, I think it was.
Yeah, that's right. And then the women one as well with there was one with all the women who. Not I want to say topless. They were topless women in a very tasteful way. That was a totally different vibe. And then you had Steer Clear of Twickenham and Cobblers. So, you know, if anyone wants to have a look at that, they were all Nike, but they were all different.
It's good to mix them up a bit. I think they all had a voice, kept them all hanging together.
Yeah. So what I actually wanted to ask, because I think it'd be really helpful for other people listening to this, and there may not be a great answer, but I'm kind of interested in what an approach to art direction really is, because I'm not an art director, and obviously Dave is, and I think when I speak to him again, I'll ask him this as well. But I'm kind of fascinated about how good art directors go about art directing. Like, what goes through your mind? What are you looking to do? How do you, you know, get it to where you want it to be?
Cool, that's tough. It is instinctive. You've got two things going on. You've got what you're advertising and what the idea is. And either one of those or both of them can dictate the way that you art direct it. Now, obviously, if it's a visually led idea, you're going to have a great illustration or a great photograph. And the type is going to be secondary. If it is a line led thing, then it might be a different balance. But, you know, I've always been, I'd like to think I was an half decent art director with the wind blowing in the right direction. When there was a trend for the more delicate, sensitive stuff, where you try and bury the logo. In fact, there's a lot of it going on now. All those scam ads you see in DNAD now, with a visual, you know, a visual idea with a tiniest logo in the bottom right-hand corner. That's never been my cup of tea, really. I like big logos. It's an advert. That doesn't mean to say that I can't do subtle. I just choose not to do it.
Well, I think there's an element where now there's a formula and people go, the formula is the smaller the logo, the bigger the picture, the fewer the elements, the more likely you are to win at Cannes. And I think there's something behind those in that it's not supposed to look like an ad. And, you know, if you don't know that it's an ad, you might read it and then, oh, look at the logo in the corner. And so there are reasons behind that. But if everyone's doing that, then where's the freshness? Where's the invention? Where's the originality, I guess?
Massive generalisation, because, you know, obviously it's horses for courses and there's some things that you want to be a bit intriguing with.
Yeah.
But generally, I think what we're doing is advertising. Why not make all of it look like advertising? You know, whether it's the telly or posters or print or whatever, you know, press ads. Why be shy about the fact that it's an advert? Because you can't, you know, at the same time, you can lead someone down the garden path and they think they're reading something else. Oh, it's a fucking advert at the end of the path. You know, so you've got to be careful with that being too intriguing.
That's true. Okay, so can I just ask, like, on the technical side of art direction, where I used to, I maybe sit with one of my art directors and look at stuff on the screen in the studio and stuff like that. Where it got a little bit mysterious for me was like, oh, the reds are a bit warm over here. The greens feels a bit cold in this corner. I don't want to say that's bullshit because I know it really matters in some way. And for me, on the copywriting side, a semicolon versus a colon versus a comma is quite an intricate process. So those technical bits of balance of colour and all that kind of stuff, is that something that's really important in what you're doing? Or again, is it instinct?
It all depends, you know, if, you know, no, is it important? Actually, no, it's not important at all. Now, the idea is the important thing. And, the, you know, the craft of the illustration or the photography, you know, obviously, if someone's going to reproduce so it fucks up a great photograph, then you've done something wrong. But once you let a big campaign go, I'm talking about press here, no one's interested in press anymore. If you let a big campaign go, you don't know where it's going to appear and what the reproduction's going to be like.
Oh, yeah.
All you can do is that you can try to make the thing that's in front of you, which used to be a transparency, and then a wet proof when I was in the agency side. Now it'd be on a computer screen. Even then, you know, computer screen's backlit, it's not printed on paper. You know, it's a minefield. But getting it right with what is it ever in front of you, whether it's a transparency, a wet proof, or whatever it is, or, you know, what's on a computer screen, is important. But given most ideas in press ads are shy now, I'm sticking press ad for ages. I go on the tube all the time and I give myself this little test. I walk up and down the platform while I'm waiting for the train, see if I can spot a good poster, good cross-track poster. There ain't any. I never see one. There's none about now. So whether the warms are a bit warm or the reds are a bit red or the bloody blues are a bit cold, it don't fucking matter. The ideas are shit, so who cares?
Well, the one thing that I found interesting in when I was working with or under Paul Belford were the number of times where we'd get to a solution that, in my opinion, was really good, and in his opinion was really good, and in the design department's opinion was really good, because we were all sort of doing this together. And then it would just get scrapped and there'd be something new tomorrow and something new the day after that and something new the day after that. And what I thought was fascinating is we, including someone as great as Paul Belford, have decided that this is good and we're cool with that. But he never stopped. he would just keep going and looking at it in another way and another way and another way.
I understand that. I love a lot of Paul stuff. You know, we're at the opposite end of the spectrum as far as art direction goes. I don't mean it is good and I'm bad, by the way.
Yeah.
It's just different tastes, different sensibilities. But I like a lot of his stuff and I get it. I do things over and over. And I'm a perfectionist. But the ideas come first, really. See, I was spoiled because for the I'm not very good at maths, but I think it was 18 and a half years that I was a art director or a creative, because I was visualizer first, as you know. I never had to use a stock shot. Never had to use a stock shot. So if I did a press ad that required a photograph, then we'd do an original photograph. And I work with, you know, really great people like Brian Griffin and Norman Parkinson and other good people that I can't remember. You know, spoil. And, you know, when I was at Leo Burnett, we'd get an illustration done, but we'd choose two illustrators, then pick which illustration we like best.
Great.
You know, that stuff don't happen anymore. You know, so I was spoiled, and now youngsters have to use stock shots. And like I said, I went through my whole career with never having to use a stock shot ever. You know, so you don't see much good photography. But in the old days, I used to be able to walk down that platform, and if you saw a Smirnoff ad or a Benson & Hedges ad or a Winston ad or any number of big campaigns, that bloody great original photography in it. It don't happen anymore. But the posters, the clients are still paying through the nose for them.
Yep.
They're still being printed. They're still up there. It's not like no one's paying for the bloody things. They might as well be good.
Yeah, a stock shot costs a lot of money. So, so give us one guess or a long, whatever it is, idea. Why aren't the posters as good today as they used to be?
Because I think it's really easy. I bet the talent in agencies is every bit as good now as it used to be. I bet all the young creatives are every bit as good as we were when we were younger. Nothing to do with them. They've all had their wings clipped. So creatives are not allowed to be creative anymore. Not to the extent that we were, where it was encouraged and you used to have superstar creatives. I've been to two or three awards shows recently where they never read the creatives' names out who were picking up the awards. Never read them out. Whereas when I was a boy, you opened Campaign and they'd see Kelly and O'Driscoll are doing this, that, and that, the other. Palmer and Denton, I wasn't a boy then. You know, I can't remember the stars. But there were big stars, you know, whether it was John Egerty or Dave Trott or Gordon Smith or whoever it was. There was the big stars that got talked about, whether they were moving agencies for big money. It's like football players' money back in the old days. And seeing creatives in a Ferrari wasn't an unusual event. I never had one. I had the company Austin Maxey. It was unusual. And now, they got paid big money because they were bloody good. And they were encouraged to be good. And having a star working on your account was probably deemed to be a good thing. Now, they don't want the big idea. You know, the big idea versus big data. You know, clients, you know, that's the clever thing. Because, you know, us as creatives, we're meant to be good salespeople. And I think we are given a chance. But the clients really have been sold a pup with the idea that a spreadsheet is more exciting than a double-page spread.
Well, there's another aspect of it. I thought you were just about to say it, but so we sell for a living, and yet we don't sell ourselves individually as people, as brands, as, you know, as what could elevate us to that star level. I wonder why that's happened and why people don't.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely dead right. Why do creatives not use these fantastic skills they've got to promote themselves and be a bigger player on and have a voice on the, you know, on the boardroom table?
Yeah, don't know.
Why are the creatives so shy? Because they're great at selling other things.
Yeah.
You know, they're given a brief and a few million quid, but why do, you know, it troubles me. I'll tell you what, this has led on to another thought. Because I like social media. I go on Facebook all the time. It's like twitching the curtain. You know, I don't know what everyone is to. And everyone was bloody moaning about the fact Brexit. Everyone was moaning about that. In a very heated way. You know, they were very upset when we voted to be out of Europe. And all the lead on the lead up, I thought, this is a great opportunity. This is a great opportunity. If anyone just takes it upon himself to do a poster campaign or a print campaign or some flyers or whatever, whether you want to stay in or you want to leave Europe, what a fantastic brief. And anyone could have picked that up. And with all these creatives moaning about, a lot of good people as well, moaning about it afterwards, I think, well, why didn't you do something very persuasive to keep us in Europe, mate? And what if you felt that strongly about it? We've got the power to do anything we want.
Yeah.
You want to promote something, promote it. You don't have to wait for a client to say, oh, here's a brief, or is it a planner to say, here, look, we're giving this to about a dozen other teams. We want 20 things to go into research, and if you're lucky, something might leak out the other side. Then we're knock all the corners off it, and then you've got something for your show reel. You know, there's lots of great courses that anyone can grab hold of, given our skills, and we can exercise what we're good at.
Yeah.
I don't know the question in the first place. I'm rambling.
I don't know. It was why we don't promote ourselves. And also, I mean, I think it's interesting because I spoke to Simon, obviously, and he had his blog, and I've had my blog and things like that. And I think you are the archetypal, if not the most extreme version of the person as brand, as far as I've known it. Because the first time I ever saw you was in Blink's offices, and you had like a tweed suit on with Denton over the back, or it might have been a tracksuit with Denton across the back and your pound sign. And one of the things I find fascinating and really admirable about what you do is you live it, you art direct your entire life. And if there's an opportunity to art direct something in your life or make it as creative as it can be, you take that opportunity. You get your clothes made specially. Your house is like a job where someone, you know, you have turned it into visually the way you want it to be. And I don't think people live it in that way. So I'm really kind of interested into why you've taken it to that degree, which is really good, and very few other people do.
Yeah, I suppose it's all part of being creative. That's why I can't understand why other people don't do it. I had my first suit made when I was 13, and I loved the experience so much that I had another one made when I was 15, and I've been having my clothes up made ever since then. And I had my first letterhead printed when I was at college. Again, it was at School of Vocational Studies. It's all about practical stuff. So they got you to do a bit of artwork, do an illustration, set some type, cut it out, stick it on a board, you know, paste up, you know, that's, I learned how to do paste up, take it down to the printers and get it printed, do some overlays. And I've got I took it to the printers, and this letterhead printed in about three different colours. Bloody hell, that's good. Before you know it, get my own cards printed. So the idea of actually drawing something on a bit of paper, whether it's a suit or a pair of socks or some print or some jewellery or anything, furniture, you know, there ain't much in, you're right, there's not much in my life that I haven't designed myself. I haven't done pants, I've done just about everything else.
I think your pants would be good.
Oh, I'll make a brand for myself. It's just that I like doing it. I remember as a little kid, actually, I used to like the Addams Family and the Munsters. And I remember my mum doing her pieces when she came home, that she'd gone out. And I was only a little kid. She'd come home and I'd kicked everything over in the hall and draped a load of string over the banisters to make it look like cobwebs. So I like the look of the Munsters' house. So I suppose I've always been doing that. So, oh yeah, actually, it's reminded me. I used to love board games as well. I used to like the graphics on board games. But I used to get like the Monopoly board and then completely redraw it. So I'd make all the pieces. So that's why all my identities and stationery look like Waddington's board games now.
Well, that kind of brings me on quite nicely to one of the more recent little art direction things you did with the Rice Krispie Squares stuff. And
yeah,
it strikes me that the people who asked you to do that felt like they wanted a sort of Mark Denton-esque answer to that brief or look to the ads.
Yeah, it's bloody daft asking me to do something else, isn't it, really? You know.
Well, at the same time, when you go back to the Nike stuff, there's a million different answers to the Nike thing, and they didn't look like Mark Denton ads, in inverted commas. But the Rice Krispie squares were very much you, I feel. So
you're dead right there, because actually I went along to take the brief, and believe it or not, I can do different things. You know, I've made this bloody big pigeonhole for myself. It's kind of cast iron pigeonhole. Because I do so much of my own stuff, then suddenly I apply my own sensibilities. But of course, when I was working on Nike or Wrangler or Levi's or Vauxhall or any of the other stuff I did as a creative, you do what was appropriate for that. You know, I didn't try to force my sensibilities onto everything. So I went on to get briefed on Rice Krispie Squares. I was taking the brief, and it just so happened that I had a lot of my coy identity. And I said, well, you know, I'm trying to drill down into what they wanted. And they said, well, we like that. I said, well, I'll do something like that. So it was as simple as that. It was brief, really. Do something like you've done before. Only a bit different.
I think I've heard you describe it as something like, I'll get this wrong, but you can correct me, like naughty schoolboy something or other with an amazing level of craft.
Well, how do you do it? It is something like that. Yeah, it's a schoolboy humour with a high-end finish.
Yeah.
Schoolboy joke with a high-end finish, yeah. You know, I've just been at work today, finishing off a magazine. Finished off this magazine that's been hanging around for a couple of years now, because it's got no deadline. I'm doing it just because I like doing it. And I've finally put it to bed. But right in the last 24 hours of doing it, I thought, oh, fuck it, I'm going to do another little book on the back of it. And I've got the artwork for another book within 24 hours. So I've got a book and a magazine. So, and I've never done anything quite like this before. I was on the phone to the printer with a sample book. You know, I'll have that kind of paper for the cover. I've got a foil sample. Yeah, I'll have that embossed and foiled in that. I'll have that paper for the inside. Just on the phone, making it up from a book. And that was exciting. And it's all puerile, the lot. Real low-end schoolboy humour, all of it. And I'm spending a bleeding fortune on it. I think it's a good combo. I like it. It seems to work for me.
Well, I think it's unique, or at least I don't see anyone else doing it. And it's a great combination of things because, you know, I think there's something really appealing. Like when you did that Crave Circle annual, there's a Beano book. For me, that was just, if you grew up, I mean, obviously it worked in your age as well, and I'm a little bit younger than you, but I grew up, you know, in the world of Whizzer and Chips and Beano and Dandy and all that kind of stuff. So seeing it reproduced again in the world of advertising was enormously enjoyable from my point of view. And I think from a lot of other people who went, oh my God, look, here's the Beano artist who drew, you know, Nasher and Dennis the Menace, or whichever one it was, here in the world of advertising. And that clash was original, distinctive, memorable, all those things that we look for in advertising.
Of course, yeah, I've got to point out that I did that with Dave. You know, that was a joy to work with Dave Dye on that. And it was Dave's original idea, but he was just setting up his own agency, or a new agency. I think it was his second or third agency he was setting up. And he said, look, I ain't got time to do it all by myself. Do you want to do it with me? So what a bloody treat that was, doing it with Dave. And then dragging out a Beano artist out of retirement and getting him to do it. So it was real, and spending a bleeding fortune on it. It was expensive, but that got nominated for DNAD, which was even better. But, you know, it's not a matter of, I don't try and force Beano sensibilities on everything, but, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier about the subtle versus unsubtle, you know, I think about what's popular. You know, I want to do stuff that's popular, generally. And punters, you think what they like. They like Anton Deck, and they like Lady Gaga, and they like Madonna, and they like, you know, Arnie Schwarzenegger. They like unsubtle stuff, you know, the stuff that's in the cinemas now. There's all the superhero stuff.
Yeah.
It ain't subtle. You know, I like the Farrelly brothers more than the Coen brothers, personally.
Yeah.
Mainly because I've got an end to a film. I prefer an end. But, you know, I like a lot of funny stuff. And that's what I miss, really. I only got into advertising in the first place. I know it's a bit of a mistake, but I used to love the adverts that made my mum laugh. And my mum's dead now, so she's not a lot of laughing going on, but I don't think she laughs a lot of the stuff that's on the telly. And what I can't get my head around is, you go to remember you used to go to the cinema, and I used to get there early because I didn't like missing the ads. Because mm-hmm. even the crap ads for Bacardi and things like that were good.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of good adverts. You know, that's where the people got the glossy adverts now. Now you go there, I don't know whether it's for a bank, I don't know if it's for an insurance company, I don't know whether it's for a telephone company, I don't know what it's for. But they're all about loads of young people laughing at each other. Having a laugh together, I should say, rather than laughing at each other. No one's told a joke, they're all laughing. Sometimes it's slow motion, all good looking people laughing. What's that all about?
I have no idea. But so the other thing I was going to ask is, because I think you once told me that the best year you ever had financially was when you were a designer. Was that the case? Did I misremember that?
I was directing at the same time though.
Okay.
So I was directing, and you know, I set up a design company because again by mistake I'd done Blink's Identity, because any creative opportunity. If someone says, "Yeah, will you design this, that, and the other for me?" I will. And so I'd been asked by a couple of production companies to design their identities, and Blink asked me, James Stanholm at Blink. But you know, they're the worst bloody clients ever, production companies. So I've been pissed about a bit doing the Knights of Godman's. And he said, "Well, do my identity." I said, "Yeah, I'll do it, but give me a free hand." And true to his word, he gave me a completely free hand, so I did whatever I wanted. And it won lots of big design awards, got into DNAD. It won the Grand Award at the New York Festivals, which was bigger than Cannes at the time, for design. Got a gold at Design Week. All these strange design awards that I'd never heard of. It won all over the bloody place. And it's only when I've got a phone call from someone saying, "Oh, congratulations." I said, "What for?" I said, "Well, you're in the top 20 most awarded design companies of the year." Design Week. I thought, what? They put me down as Mark Denton Design. I thought, well, that's fun. That's happened by mistake. So I started a company called Mark Denton Design, because I thought, I'll try and stay in the chart as long as possible. So, but that year, again, I just set that up just for fun, really. That year, I made a lot of money from that, and did a load of commercials at the same time. And then I spunked it all on a book about Mexican wrestling, which seemed like a very good idea at the time.
Yeah, I had one of your T-shirts. It was a very good idea. Thanks very much. I was going to ask you, what's the difference then, really, between design and art direction? Is there one? Or is it just who you do it for?
There's no difference at all. Apart from design is not very funny.
Except your design. And I think when you did therapy films and you had that thing with the monkey, that was really good and funny as well. So maybe we now we can stray into your time as a director. What made you then want to, you know, take that path?
Oh, look, I started directing because I got fired from Simon's Palmer. And I was out on the street, and we'd had a couple of bloody good years. I'd won lots of awards. Because, you know, I was chasing awards from as early as I could, because... I know I'm changing the subject slightly, but it's relevant.
Go for it.
Don't be fooled by this acquired media accent. I'm quite common. So I never thought I was meant to be in advertising in the first place. So I've always been looking over my shoulder from day one. They're going to find out. So I chased awards because I thought someone would listen to me if I won lots of awards, and it might ensure that I'd be hanging around a little bit. So... I forgot what the question was now, but that was relevant. But then again, I've forgotten.
About going into direction.
Oh, directing, yeah. So it's me peddling like bloody mad to make our agency. I wanted to be the new CDP. When I was growing up, CDP was the agency, then BNP. Yeah. But CDP was the number one agency. I thought, right, okay, we've got our own agency. And Chris was the same as me. We just wanted to be the best. And at the time, the best way of actually gauging whether you're any good or not was whether you won awards or not. I couldn't see any other way. I certainly didn't think, oh, let's start an agency and make loads of money, naively. But of course, the partners I was with, that probably was the reason they wanted to set up an agency.
Probably.
So, and you know, I could see there's a circle of life. And it's, I can see it's really good to get hungry, creative people into an agency early on so you get the fame. And we did get creative fame before we got financial fame. And then, generally, really bloody good creatives back then, you're not allowed to argue now, you're not allowed to be awkward, but really good creative people were fucking awkward back then. And me and Chris had a lot of success in a relatively short amount of time. Remember, Chris had only been in the business 4.5 years and we had our own agency 4.5 years.
Wow.
So we were bloody awkward. He was more awkward than me, but collectively we were bloody awkward. So we got fired from Simons Palmer, even though we were ab for ab, probably winning more awards than anyone else. So I'm out on the street thinking, what the fuck am I going to do now? I had a good year last year, won lots of awards. I couldn't win any more if I tried. So that's not a lot good to me. So I didn't trust the process really because I'd just been kicked out on the arse. And I thought, I'll give directing a bash. I don't know if I'm going to like it. I don't know if I'm going to get on with it, but I'll have a go. And while I make up my mind what I want to do, here I am, 22 and a half years later, still doing it. So that's interesting.
Yeah, so...
Or it might not be interesting, but...
No, it is.
So I've made my mind up what I want to do.
But I think that awkwardness that you're talking about is also interesting because, you know, in a lot of ways, Simons Palmer as an agency had a winning formula in terms of doing good, famous, big, you know, high-quality advertising. And yet the people in charge, because you were, as you say, awkward, wanted to, like, kill the golden goose. I mean, that just seems really odd to me, but I guess what they wanted, a quiet life and worst advertising? Is that how it went? Because it went down soon afterwards.
It had a bit of momentum by the time our tenure was up. It had momentum now I'm a little bit older and wiser. If I was in their shoes, I would have probably fired me and Chris. In first, he was more awkward than me. I can see the logic behind it.
All right. Well, the department you had also spawned a lot of very, very successful creatives and creative directors. Do you think that was partly down to the talent spotting or partly down to how you shaped those people and what they learned from you as well? You can be as modest or as unmodest as you like.
I tried modesty for the first 30 years of my career. Waste of bloody time. I think a bit of both. Is me being immodest. I'm a bloody good talent spotter. You know, I'm probably a better talent spotter than I am a creative. I can spot talent. All the people who worked with us were good. They were good because they were good, you know. And I'd like to think that we shone a spotlight on them and maybe gave them a bit of good advice. From what Dave said in his interview, we didn't actually say much apart from keep going till we like it. So I don't know whether we gave anyone any pearls of wisdom. But, I think about the people who worked for us. Tony Barry, bloody good. Paul Silburn, bloody good. Sean Doyle, bloody excellent. Dave Dye, fantastic. Tiger, got a big profile shortly after she left us. Andy McKay, you know, everyone was winning awards. But they couldn't have done it unless they were good in the first place. And like I said, we opted to go from the people who hadn't made it to go for the people who hadn't made it because they were cheaper to start off with. How much of it is, what did they learn from me? Oh, I don't bloody know, you'll have to ask them. Did Dave learn anything from me by me saying, oh, very good, Dave, that looks like a Nike head, try it again?
Well, it made him look like, even that one principle might have been, okay, I shouldn't make my ads look like all the same ads from the same client, and if I've come to a good solution, that shouldn't stop me, I should go and have a look again, you know, things like that. But, you know, maybe, I don't know, do you think you learned important stuff off your creative directors, like Hegarty and people like that?
Oh, bloody hell, yeah. And he didn't give much away either. You know, I was shit scared at BBH because, like I said, I thought I was a pretender and I hadn't done much print. And I used to stay late at night going through the guard books, trying to work out how to do this art direction stuff. And I could, before long, I thought, well, there's a lot of stuff in Bodoni here. And John Hegarty doing a Levi's trade campaign, and he used Clarendon Bowl condensed as a body face, I think it was. And I thought, oh, that's bloody good. See, Clarendon's one of my favourite typefaces now. You know, and you know that from BBH. And Scott's New Roman, I think it was on St Ival Shape ads. So I made sure I knew all the typefaces in all the campaigns, and I got the hang of it in the end. If you look at my book, I've still got a lot of stuff that I'm proud of now, lurking around from BBH days. That's where I learned how to alter it, because whether Hegarty actually said, "Oh, right, try this, that, and the other," he just picked it up. He picked it up, and I knew that if John raised his eyebrows because I hadn't put the right grounding shadow underneath a photograph, I knew that I wouldn't do that again.
There you go.
I really wanted to please him. He was a hard man. I really wanted to please him. And I used to do all the adapts. I used to do traces for all the adapts. I don't even know. You know, you get a mechanical and you get the basic mechanical. Then there's lots of adapts depending on where it runs, you know, lots of different sizes. And I used to do a trace for all the different adapts, just from my paste up experience. That's what we used to have to do. So it's very useful, that studio stuff. And I remember John saying, "You shouldn't be doing that. You know, that gets done by the studio." And I think he secretly kind of admired that I was doing traces for every single adapt. I still do traces now. I'm not very good on the computer. That's why I surround myself with young people. I've still got tracing pads, and I've got a grand projector. I should get myself one.
I think there's one in Saatchi's creative department. Unless they've cleaned that place up, there's so much junk in Saatchi's corridors. Or there was when I was freelancing there a few years ago. But if you want one, I reckon that's your place. But
to be honest, I've surrounded myself with enough young people, and you know, that's thinking about talent spotting earlier and what worked for us at Simon's Palmer and getting these young people. Even now, you know, I look after a few photographers, and we still do a lot of and graphic designers as well. Still, I still do a lot of graphics and stuff like that. And generally, I don't do it because I think, oh, this is a good business-like thing to do. People ring me up and say, "Oh, I'm a photographer. Can I show you my book? And can you help me with a bit of self-promotion?" Before you know it, I say, "Why don't you just sit on my website and we'll do some stuff together and we'll see if we can make you famous." And that stuff seems to happen quite a lot. And I like doing it. I get a lot out of it. They get a lot out of it. Getting a keen, young, ambitious young person next year, it's like getting some jump leads applied to your testicles.
Always handy.
Try it.
I will. And as a director, I guess you end up being part of a collaborative end of a process where someone's already come up with an idea. And do you find it hard to not, I don't know, rewrite it or want to change things? Or
if I think of a cherry that would look good on the top of their cake, I'll certainly offer it. You know, that's what creatives want.
Yeah.
You're pitching for something. They want you to take their idea. I'm only, you know, I know this because I was a creative. You want someone to take it away. That's why we gave stuff to the likes of Tony Kaye. You know, because he'd take your idea and completely ignore it, but do something great and win an award with it. Or you give it to Frank Budgeon and he'd give you something that you think, oh, fucking hell, that's a bit different, but isn't it good? So you want someone to take your idea, not lose the essence of the idea, but just put the cherry on top of the cake. But, you know, that's reminded me about another bee in my bonnet. Am I moaning all the bloody time?
No.
You know, the fact that you have to treat now, you know, treatments mean nothing at all. They mean absolutely nothing. Look at the bloke's reel or the lady's reel, the director's reel. Look at that. Have a chat with them. See if they're on the right wavelength. That means everything. All the evidence is there. I just lost a job recently. I'm not just bitter about that because you know, it's very interesting losing jobs actually, because you formulate an opinion of how things should look and then you see someone else's effort. I've got to say, I've never lost a job where I didn't think I could do it better, but maybe every director thinks that. But I just lost a job recently where I got the phone call and this is, and I've got a bloody good hit rate. I get about between 1 in 3 and 1 in 4 jobs that I win. Apparently, that's pretty good. But I lost this job. It had some food in it. It's for a food client. And they said, right, it was very close. We spent a lot of time agonising over the decision, but we just had to give it to the other person because he had this very interesting insight. And it's always very close. I'd rather say you were a million miles off. Oh boy, very close. That don't help me at all. No. Say I was completely wrong. Just too radical or something. That's much nicer. But anyway, it's really close. He had this interesting insight about the food, and the client loved that. And I thought, well, now if they've got a specialist food person, I can understand that. I put in the treatment, I spend a lot of time on the food. I know I've done a lot of food ads in my time. I've done a lot of food print work, so I know a little bit about food photography. But if they've got a real specialist in there, they know stuff that I don't. So get it. Anyway, I saw the finished advert. Well, not only was the joke not funny, and I was concentrating on trying to make the joke a bit funnier, but the food looked like a cat had had a crap on a plate. I thought, they've bought a director who has said they've got this interesting insight into the way the food's handled. But of course, I don't know whether the director's written treatment or is a treatment writer. Now, you're a writer. You could probably write a couple of paragraphs eulogising, I've used that word, I don't even know what it means, eulogising about this beautiful food shop, how the light's going to bounce off the spuds and there's going to be a soft focus here and we're going to glance around it and the steam's going to rise from the broccoli and the... But you could probably paint a lovely picture with that with words.
Yeah.
Me, I say, oh, mate, the food's going to be great. We're going to spend a lot of time on it. I've got a lot of experience doing food. Don't worry, I'm on that. That's what I might say, something like that.
Yeah.
And, but of course, I don't know how much you know about food photography or how much experience you've got. Yours would sound better than mine. I know you're a copywriter, so I know you don't know about warm reds and cold blues. So I imagine that when it comes to the day where you're lining up on that shot, despite the fact you've written these bloody great paragraphs about how good this food shot's going to be, when you're lining up on it, you might not have a bloody clue what you're doing. That's what treatments are worth, especially the treatment writers written.
The fact that people write you get people write the treatment who don't direct the spots, because inevitably, if you're a director, you're not necessarily going to be the best person to almost like write your own. Some of them are like 30, 40 pages long as well, with all sorts of pictures that a picture researcher has found, all sorts of words that a treatment writer has written. It's weird. And how come we were fine in the old days when there were no treatments, and yet now we need treatments?
Yeah, you look at the poor Frank dead now, but you look at Israel, and I should imagine most of the great stuff was done without treatment. Look at Tony Kaye's classic reel. Most of it wouldn't have had a treatment anywhere near it. In fact, the first 10 years I started since I was a director, no one asked me for treatment. I didn't do any. But I'll do them. Anyone got a script out there, send them to me. I'll do the treatment. I'll write them. I won't get a treatment writer.
Can we just do the one specific ad story that I think would be really illustrative, because you touched on it before, but the fact that Tony Kaye did the absolutely nothing like the ad you wanted for Can I Kick It? Could you explain how that happened and, maybe what the original thing was, but the despair that went into seeing his first cut and all that sort of stuff?
Well, for me, there wasn't any despair, but I'll tell you a story. There was despair early on, but not at the first cut stage. We wrote this ad, had an idea to it. I could tell you about the idea. Is it worth it? Tony completely ignored the idea. And as the process was going on, we thought, oh, fucking hell, he's going off at a tangent a bit here. He might be losing the idea. So we said, look, here, Tony, do us a storyboard with you, will you? And he resisted, but we put pressure on him. And he came back with the storyboard, and then he completely ignored it. So the idea was lost completely. Throughout the process, I started off really anxious, and then I thought, hang about, we've got Tony Kaye in, he's bloody good, he's got this ability to turn things into magic. I think we should let him be Tony Kaye. So I backed off then. Chris stayed with it, tried to fault it a bit, but you know, Tony was a free spirit. I was going to say loose cannon, then, but he was a free spirit then. He did come back with something magical, which just reminds me, because I'm going to talk about Simon's Palmer here, just go refer back to it. We were bloody good. Me and Chris, bloody good. That I have a good creatives about. I've met loads of good creatives in my career. The reason why we were so phenomenally successful, and we were so phenomenally successful as an agency, was because we had the best salesmen. Carl Johnson and Mike Perry were the best account men I've ever seen. So the fact is, you can be really talented. If you ain't got anyone good selling your work, then you might as well go home. And we had the best. And Carl Johnson was the best I've, you know, despite the fact he fired me, he was the best I've ever seen. And I remember on Nike, we ended up with a 60-second cut that was nothing like the original script. And there's a lot of money spent on it. I think over $500,000. There's a lot of money spent on that. And I remember the conversation, the presentation, where Carl put it on and the client said, this is nothing like the ad that I bought. But Carl said, no, but it's good, isn't it? And he agreed, and that was a done deal. You know, and that's the sort of relationship we have with our clients. You know, Carl only failed to sell one ad in our first year. One ad. He was bloody phenomenal. So we almost anything we... If we did anything bad, it wasn't because the client made us do something bad. If you can remember anything from Simon's part, he thought that was duff. That's the best me and Chris could do, because we got everything through.
Wow, that must have been amazing. So we've gone over an hour a bit, and obviously we could talk for several hours. But I didn't know if there was anything you wanted to say that we haven't covered, or anything you want to say about the way things are now. Or I don't know. Is there anything?
I'll say that things have changed, haven't they? They ain't half as good creatively. Ain't half as good. There ain't anything to do with the fact that creatives are not as good. They're clever. I've worked with a few young creatives. They're sharp. They're just as sharp and funny as the creative departments when I was a boy. But because they've had their wings clipped, you've got to look at other ways of being creative. And if you look around, people they've got their own microbreweries. They're publishing their own stuff. They're doing online things. They're doing blogs. They're doing this, that, and the other. That's where the clients have been shortchanged, because they've been sold this idea of, oh, we get loads of ideas, we put them all into research, take your pick, oh, you want to turn them upside down and change the blues to red? Yeah, we do that. We do anything you want. So the clients have got all their own way, but what they haven't got is creatives working around the clock in their own time trying to make their ads good, because the clients clock off as soon as they can now, and massive generalisation, because there's some people still stick at it, but they clock off as soon as they can, and they go and roll their sleeves up and get stuck into their microbrewery, or their blog, or their whatever, their photography. You know, and that's the stuff that clients used to get for free. You know, passionate creatives. Now creative, it's like doing the bleeding lottery. You write something, what's the chances of getting it made? And if you get it made, what's the chances of it being good? Because, you know, the vultures haven't been pecking at it. And that's the tough thing. But what's exciting about now, production has never been cheaper. So I'm producing magazines, I'm doing my own little short films, we're doing loads of stuff, getting it out in the world. You know, I still like advertising. I like difficult clients. I really like, give us some difficult clients. I like trying to persuade them to do good stuff. I find that a big challenge. You know, you can't be bullshit, you've got to put your arm around them. You know, it's more dangerous nowadays. There's less money swashing about, but it's more, in some ways, it's more fun. You know, it's like a trial. You know, I was lucky. You know, again, it's all timing. I was bloody lucky. I was in advertising when there was money about. I'm 60. I could jack it in. I don't need to do it for the money. Just through luck, you know, being busy and being in advertising for a long time when there was money swashing about. But I like being in it. I like working with people. I like getting a result despite the adverse environment. That's interesting. Just stirring the pot up a little bit. You know, I've got this project at the moment. I'm doing another magazine after I put this one to bed. I've already got about four small clients. And I'm going to get loads of creatives involved in it. I'm going to let them, give them a free hand, do a load of great stuff. And I'm going to make it better than the stuff that's being churned out by the networks. Might be a stupid pipe dream. I'm going to have a go at that. And just get people excited about print again. That would be an interesting thing. Because it's not like there's no money being spent on it. There's tons of money being spent on it. But for shy. And, massive generalisation, but it is rubbish. So, you know, there are lots of exciting things still to get involved in. Yeah, I've got most of them. I've got so many bloody projects on at the moment. I've never been busier. I got back from South Africa 2 weeks ago, and I haven't had a day off. I'm working this weekend. I've been getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Set me an alarm for 3 o'clock just to get the extra hours in. It's that thrilling, the amount of stuff that's floating about. Doing things through agencies is tough. Getting great work through agencies is tough. What I love is the dangerous bit where everyone's nibbling off of each other's plates. The amount of production companies that are trying to approach clients. The amount of agencies are looking to produce their own commercials. Everyone's feeding off of each other's plates. Bloody brilliant. You know, I'm getting pulled in all over the place by agencies wanting me to direct for them, by agencies wanting me to write stuff for them. I've been storyboarding for other directors and designing costumes for other directors. I don't mind doing any of that stuff. It's fun.
Well, I think that actually it ties up to what we were talking about earlier on about the fact that you really live it. But I think that's also a really positive note to end on for anyone who's out there thinking, well, you know, my day-to-day thing isn't as good as it can be. I mean, it's as good as you make it, and all the opportunities are out there. It's not like the world has made a decision to make shit, boring, uncreative stuff. I mean, the opportunities pretty much are endless, and it's a matter of whether you want to take them and make them or not. And it's just right there in your hand. And, you know, if you've got too much on your plate, get a bigger plate.
Brilliant.
So, huge thanks, Mark. I think that's been brilliant. I think at some point it'd be great to do another chat, because I'm sure there's a whole load more left in the tank.
I had loads of good things to tell you about, and then obviously I forgot.
Well, we'll get to them. I'll circle round and we'll have another chat in the future. But for now, that's brilliant, and thanks very much. And I'll stick it up and send it to you. And I hope everyone else gets just as inspired.
Yeah, you probably need the name of my lawyers.
Possibly. We'll put that on the blog for anyone who needs to contact you for those reasons. Okay. Cheers, Mark.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you. Thanks.
This is a podcast that watches Christmas.